Welcome to the TF Blockchain Podcast, where we interview blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency innovators actively building, growing, and investing in this emerging technology. I'm your host and founder of TF Blockchain, Jonathan G. Blanco. TF Blockchain hosts quarterly conferences and monthly events live recorded for this podcast. Our current chapters are located in Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, San Francisco, Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas. Our upcoming conferences will be TF5 in Seattle on March 19th, 2020, and TF6 in Austin on June 4th, 2020. To get involved with TF Blockchain, participate in future TF conferences, attend a chapter in your area, or to start a new chapter, please visit tfblock.io. Hey, I want to share a special promo with you from our friends over at CoinMine, so you can get your very own CoinMine 1 and mine cryptocurrency from your house in the simplest way possible. I have one, I love it, and I want to make sure you can get one too. So visit coinmine.com/tfblock and use discount code TFBLOCK to get $50 off. This podcast is presented by TF Labs, a blockchain product and startup studio. TF Labs collaborates with companies from growth stage to enterprise in order to establish their blockchain product strategy. As a startup studio, TF Labs builds and validates internal products to one day be spun out as companies. To partner or get involved with TF Labs, please visit us at tflabs.io. All right, everybody. This is Jonathan Blanco with TF Blockchain. I'm here with Mitchell Moose. He's the managing editor
of at Crypto Briefing.
At Crypto Briefing. It's the night before Christmas Eve. We were chatting earlier. I was like, hey, let's do a podcast real quick for fun.
Heck yeah. I mean, what else would I do before Christmas Eve?
Yeah. So we're here at my office right now today. Normally, we record all our events in front of an audience. Our audience is my dog, Balto. So hopefully he doesn't bark, but we'll have some fun anyway. Let him clap.
I'm excited. Balto seems like a good guest today.
He's chilling down there. Anyways, man, so why don't you introduce yourselves, everybody?
I'm Mitchell. I've been a technologist and a journalist for my short 3-year career. I've primarily spent my entire career in cryptocurrency and blockchain, and I just love tinkering with gadgets and software.
And why? Because you just started with some mining, right? Just kind of at-home mining type of thing?
Well, yeah. My first startup that I raised significant money against was a mining software company. And like many first startups, it imploded.
Nice.
It was glorious. It was a fun. It was lots of good lessons learned from that. But would certainly do it again.
Nice. So tell me more about that. I didn't realize that you fundraised for it.
Yeah. So it was the... We started just before the height of 2017, and me and four other guys, one fellow who did machine learning stuff at Facebook, two other computer science grads from the UW, and one other hardware guy, we all got together and we built and optimized GPU-based mining hardware. First off, we started by trying to build the perfect rig, and we really went down from every single screw, every single component to make it as cost-effective as possible, because this is when it was still hobbyist dominated. So the GPU market was still quite fragmented and differentiated. So there was a lot of opportunity to make an impact there. But what we realized is that the hardware side of things wasn't where a lot of the money was to be made, but the optimizations on the software side were a lot more scalable, more interesting, and had the opportunity to make a lot more money from it.
Totally. Yeah, hardware is tough.
Yeah.
Especially when you have to, have a BOM, your bill of materials, and
It's a commodity. It's not differentiated.
For
so
sure. Quality control.
Just yesterday, I met someone who had basically developed my product. That they're doing. They're doing algorithmic profit switching between different GPU-based coins, and they are a $100 million business. So it wasn't a bad idea. We just didn't execute properly. But it is what it is. Many opportunities to be had. More opportunities to be had.
Yeah, I mean, execution is what it's all about, right? That makes me think of things that get covered in journalism, which we'll get to, I'm sure, as you're a journalist. But, I think about a lot of these coins or a lot of these companies that have raised money, and they are able to execute, they're able to go very long without executing because of cash on hand, right? It's kind of a dealer's choice, I guess, on that.
Well, I mean, that's more seems like of a holdover from just the ICO mania days where the primary business model was companies raising money up front before demonstrating any sort of reasonable growth. And once they have the money in hand, there's very little incentive to meet particular targets and show any sort of performance. So you're kind of in a tough bind. Say if you raise $100 million as an entrepreneur and you're not making any progress, what do you do then?
For sure.
Do you just keep trying to make something work, or do you pivot away from the initial vision and then get attacked for pivoting, or do you just give back the money and then admit that this venture failed? Like, there's not very many good options.
Totally.
There.
No, that's, I mean, it's a fair point. You're putting yourself in a bad position right out the gate, because, you know, in a traditional funding model, sure, you're giving up equity and all these sort of things, but you know, it's very much milestone based, right? Like, you're not going to get your next round of funding until you meet those milestones. Whereas, you know, in that model, it's more everything up front. And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, even with just, you know, seed rounds or funding, is that, you know, a company might raise $2 million, but it doesn't mean that they have $2 million in their account, right? Because it might be tranched out from the investor themselves, right?
Exactly. So that $2 million isn't actually just $2 million that they can do whatever they want with. It's
right.
$2 million if you get to... you double your customer base, or you increase,
for sure,
increase your revenue by 25%. And those kinds of milestones are what hold at least traditional startups more accountable.
Yeah, totally. So what got you on the journalism side of thing? What made that part interesting, going from building tech to writing about tech?
Just like getting into crypto is kind of a big accident as well.
Yeah.
I used to write a lot about different optimizations in the mining world, and it did really well because no one was really studying it like a science, and I took a lot of time to break things down and just show people, like, a lot of the reason why people got involved in cryptocurrency is because the tech is cool and it's an opportunity to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And mining is often the gateway drug, as some people have called it, into the cryptocurrency world. So,
well, it's what's crazy to me about when you think about mining overall is where we're at now in kind of the cryptocurrency awareness, blockchain awareness, and frankly, like, the lack of education for the layman when it comes to mining overall, right? Like, you know, I'll include myself in that. And I've really taken upon myself, for instance, to just try and learn as much as I can about mining, you know, talking with some folks much smarter than I that are in the space and learning about that, because it's the backbone of everything, right? So. Super interesting.
Unless proof of stake eventually works, so could be it's the backbone of everything for now.
Well, I'm very much a person of, hey, build the future, and you know, you can do anything with technology, but exactly what you just said is that for now it's not all the way there, right? Well, cool. So you started writing about it because you're like, no one's doing this as awesome as I can do it. And
something along those lines, yeah.
And when did you turn from kind of like this more, I don't know, call it research or like paper, you know, white papers type, not white paper in your ICO sense, but like from an informational sense, to actually like reporting on news or paying attention to what other people are doing? When did that kind of flip happen for you?
So prior to moving back to the United States, I was in Bangalore, India, setting up a development workshop for one of the companies that was benefiting from the 2017 ICO craze. And I was one of their ops guys. And in Bangalore, it's definitely a different experience than if living in the United States.
Yeah.
So you get burnt out pretty quickly because infrastructure there isn't as developed as it is here. So I landed back in Seattle, and I was writing for CryptoSlate at the time as one of their contributors, and my content performed really well. And the first day I was back, they offered me a job and an apartment. So I was just like, sounds like a fun thing to do.
Yeah. Nice.
From that point forward, I was a journalist.
Okay. So that's the requirements. Nice. Well, we know CryptoSlate, obviously. Nate's a great guy and what he's doing there. And so you were doing that for like about a year or so before, and
yeah,
now,
more or less.
Okay, and now you're a crypto briefing. What are you doing there? Same thing.
Actually, I've kind of now I do less of on the ground reporting, and now it's about more about managing a team and building in effective processes and trying to modernize the journalism field. Because journalism tends to be pretty old school. They don't tend to be the first adopters of technology. So we're trying to build a technology first media firm, and a lot of that means implementing the best practices and the newest tech, the newest communication tools into trying to get the fastest and most accurate reporting.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Well, let's go into just what it means to be a cryptocurrency journalist, right? So there's definitely cult followings that some journalists have in the space. I think of people like LeQuen on Twitter, Leah Cohen.
Yeah, Leah Cohen.
Leah Cohen, yeah. You think of people like her. She has, you know, great following. And then, you know, you got the guys at The Block. And, there's what's great is that there's lots of great writing out there. But before we get to the great writing, you know, there's also like a lot of just like bad writing, you know, paid shill. I feel like we're getting over that. I'm not seeing as much of that as I used to.
Well, a lot of that's a function of ICO money. So depending on how much easy money there is that's available, the more likelihood there's going to be shill content.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's good. And, you know, in that is that, you know, there's been quite a few conversations online. It seems that every time there's different points of view, whether, you know, hey, like I want, I'm a Bitcoin person or I'm an Ethereum person, you know, that ends up being news, right? Like just, was it yesterday or the day before where Vitalik and the guys from Blockstream were going back and forth and then they threw out Binance in there, how Binance isn't decentralized. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
It's interesting how there's the technology reporting, but then there's also like this, call it Entertainment Tonight, E! News style of reporting as well. Why is that, you think? Is it just the shock factor?
Well, I think it's just regular politicking. I feel that these communities are very, very adamant about their particular technologies, and they tend to be deeply invested supporters. And Twitter isn't a medium that tends to favor moderates, so being more radical tends to help you get more reach on that platform. So from a strategy standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, I think that being ideologically in one camp or another makes the most sense. And for me personally, it's hard to find people that are objective and centrist about the cryptocurrency sphere. And once you do find those people, they tend to be some of the most valuable voices, but they also tend to be not the super popular people who tend to be championing a particular project.
Yeah, that's super fair. And that's not, you know, I think about it, I think I agree with you a little bit on that too, from the people that I see that, you know, the ones with the biggest followings are typically the most maximalist towards whatever it is that they're doing, right?
Right. So the more radical you are, the bigger your following typically. So if you're talking about a strategy that's meant to be optimized for Twitter, like being a maximalist in one category tends to have the best results.
Yeah. And so, you know, what are some fun things that you're seeing on the journalism front when you think about just from a reporting angle, like from when you first started to now? And how, you know, not just cryptocurrency or blockchain or Bitcoin type of articles, but how that's starting to get more and more mainstream.
Well, what do you mean by mainstream? So can you clarify?
For example, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, like CNN had an article where it was like, hey, if you put a dollar in Bitcoin, it'd be worth $90,000 today, right? And so you're starting to see, and like on CNBC, you know, Bitcoin gets talked about weekly, if not several times a week, right? You know, you have folks like Pomp on Squawk Box or things like that. What do you think it takes, and does it matter, I guess, when I'm saying this, like, what do you think it takes to get more reporting in traditional media? And, like, one, does it matter, or is there just opportunity for a crypto media to kind of grow into this and be more mainstream?
Well, I'll say two things. First is I think that the quality of traditional media coverage has improved substantially since 2017. For example, the articles you'd see in Wall Street Journal and in Bloomberg and even in CNBC, the quality of those pieces has improved dramatically. Before, you'd find glaring inaccuracies and you just see that this was just very crude reporting on the technology and not giving it very much nuance. But now, for example, Bloomberg even has a whole section dedicated to cryptocurrency alone. So the traditional media sector is definitely catching up when it comes to reporting in this particular field. Now, when it comes to the cryptocurrency specific side of reporting, I will say that I think the incumbents like CoinDesk has done a really good job of cementing itself as one of the leaders in this particular industry, and they definitely have had a edge in being here since 2014. So having that staying power means a lot as a media organization.
For sure. Yeah, are they by DCG? Like
they're owned by DCG. Yeah. So there are questions about how biased they are and whether their reporting is comprehensive and how they treat altcoins in particular. But overall, I think CoinDesk does a pretty good job at covering the cryptocurrency space in a fair way so far. And it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I
would say, you didn't mention, what does it take for there to be more mainstream media coverage? I think the primary factor is that people have to care about it. Right now, there's maybe 40 million people that are actively invested in cryptocurrency based on like the number of accounts between different exchanges and the overall number of addresses. So you're really not talking about a very large addressable market worldwide. Like the people who are actively in crypto, they're surrounded by other crypto enthusiasts, so they see it as inevitable, but it really is still very quite early in the adoption cycle for this. So even as an organization, if you max out at 40 million customers, that's a very difficult proposition. And that means for something like a media organization, you're going to have to stay relatively small to serve that market, because at most, you're maybe going to be able to capture 70% of that market. So for CoinDesk, that means that their maximum revenue is really, really capped and how much they could potentially make as an organization. So what really requires for there to be better mainstream coverage is to have fundamentally more adoption. So more adoption also means that overall the market capitalizations and liquidity of these different assets need to increase. And I mean, it's a combination of different factors here. There needs to be additional institutional interest, but for institutional interest to be there also needs to be a larger market. Yeah. So it's kind of a slow going adoption process, and that isn't going to change until there's more stability and more certainty around Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, and just overall adoption in general, right? So, you know, the applications or products that people are using, and you know, the everyday person is using things without, I guess, even realizing that they're using cryptocurrency. And, you know, it has to go outside of that, just buying and selling on an exchange for the functionality of it, right? You know, I think that's, for me, one of the reasons why I found Libra so fascinating. Not from like, you know, a tech standpoint or even from a coin standpoint, but more from like an overall adoption standpoint is what made, to me, what I find so interesting about Libra, right? Is when you start thinking about, you know, who's on Facebook? Okay, what is it? It has to be over 2 billion people by now. And, you know, you think about the demographic range of folks that are on Facebook. So then when you put something in their hands that now they have a taste of what, you know, cryptocurrency is, sure, it's not going to be decentralized. You know, it's not truly blockchain, right? But if that ends up being like the intro point, the gateway, that's what gets talked on mainstream media so much that, you know, and Congress and all these folks are interested in it so much that, you know, Zuckerberg does a hearing on it. You know, those are, I think, the things that kind of lead to that.
I also think it's for Libra specifically, it's a big perception thing, whether you want to call it a cryptocurrency or not, because the idea of having some sort of electronic digital cash to replace the US dollar has been around like since PayPal in 1999. That was what they set out to create, and that's what effectively this multi-hundred billion dollar company is already doing. So really the controversial point is, how much control do regulators, or will regulators be able to have over the system that is created? And I think that's mainly the point of contention in all cryptocurrencies, is that if you create something, who's going to be responsible and liable for the problems that such a system creates, and how are you going to be able to mitigate bad actors from using that system to transfer value? And it's going to be very hard for regulators to swallow something that's completely unregulated, and then also allowing on-ramps and off-ramps to participate in that system without having any oversight. So there needs to be additional work there for something, even like for both Bitcoin and for Libra, to be able to get more acceptance from mainstream financial institutions. And that's one of the major catches with this whole adoption thing, is that a lot of the crypto OGs and the cypherpunks, they don't necessarily want financial institutions, and they don't necessarily want to be included in the traditional financial system, because that's the very thing that Bitcoin was supposedly created to combat against.
Which is interesting, right? Because it's if you're a bag holder, it's to your best interest to have mass adoption, right? Because if more people are using it, like in theory, the value should go up. But if you have to do things outside of the legacy financial system, or without, call it just better UI, you know, you're going to have to give up some level of custodianship to have some of those benefits that you get with transacting the way someone's used to. Like, you know, my mom, for example, she got an email from Apple because she doesn't have an Apple phone anymore, so she has an Android phone, and so she doesn't pay attention to her Apple or iTunes or login or whatever. And she's like, "Jonathan, can you please help me manage my photos that are on my Apple, on my iTunes, or photo or whatever it is?" And I'm like, "Well, shit, like, I can't imagine my mom handling private keys, right? Like, she just never would." And so then it comes down to, like, you know, does a Bitcoin maximalist care about mass adoption, or does a Bitcoin maximalist strictly just care about utility in this,
or price appreciation,
or yeah, right? So like, what is that about? What do you think on that?
Well, I saw an interesting question posed on Twitter today, where they hypothetically posed, would maximalists rather have mass adoption and Bitcoin be worth $10, or would they rather have hardly any people use it, but Bitcoin's worth $100,000? And I find that it's kind of a difficult question to answer, because a lot of people may mistakenly make this assumption that adoption and price appreciation are linked, but there's many cryptocurrencies in many cases where the economics don't necessarily work out that way. So for example, Ripple may not necessarily appreciate if more people use that system, because the whole underlying assumption is that people are quickly liquidating their holdings. They don't necessarily need to hold XRP for settlement. So do the underlying economic incentives align in such a way where mass adoption also equates to price appreciation? And does price appreciation potentially undermine whatever the fundamental purpose of the token is? So for example, if you have a utility token, oftentimes it's not advantageous to have random price fluctuations. Like for example, Augur. In the Augur system, when they're trying to make, it's a prediction market, decentralized prediction market is what they're trying to build. Having the price of Augur fluctuate when you have a bet that spans for an entire year is a huge headache, because if you're trying to make a bet, you want to know with certainty that the amounts that you bet initially are similar to what the end result's going to be, and that so that people continue making bets that are denominated in the same way. So a large issue with prediction markets is that they should have some sort of stable coin to facilitate bets on their systems, but no one has built a liquid decentralized betting market yet. And one of the main problems with that is the volatility in those cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I didn't realize there wasn't a stable coin in that scenario.
Yeah, so not only are you betting on the actual event happening or not happening, you are also betting on what the price of Augur is going to be in the future.
Interesting. Yeah, because, you know, when I start to think about stable coins and I just immediately go to commerce, you know, and how we think about transactions, and I kind of just see this world where your loyalty point evolves into a cryptocurrency and it being a stable coin, right? And
why would some of these companies want a loyalty point as a stable coin? Why wouldn't they just want to have it as a loyalty point?
Not relying on the rails of the past of, you know, these legacy loyalty type systems, right? So like a lot of the loyalty systems that are out there are super dated, you know, early 90s type things, you know, patchwork on patchwork. It's like the reinvention of miles, of a mileage plan. So for example, if you're, you know, Alaska Airlines, we're in Seattle or Delta or whoever it is, you know, a lot of people don't realize is that when you earn or can use or spend those points, say like at a Marriott or a hotel, that mileage is on the books of the hotel. So it's all about kind of called like the new version of loyalty is kind of how I see it. So, I mean, a lot of things have to change or evolve in that, and things will have to take place, but I think there's some interesting factors there. Should we talk price?
We can talk price.
So I remember we were talking a while ago, back when, you know, things went from 3,000 to 5,000, you know, kind of felt like overnight back in April 2019. We've kind of been like fluctuating up and down on the, you know, for a while it was just going up and down above 10,000, right? It felt like it was going up a little bit above, a little bit below, a little bit above. We've been hovering at the 7,000 mark now. Seems like for what, 2 months now?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? What do you think changes that? We don't have to like predict, you know, 100,000 Bitcoin, John McAfee style, but
I'd rather have my genitalia be intact. Thank you very much.
Is he gonna do it?
I don't think he'll do it.
No, there's
he's
no
a
way
chicken.
He'll do it.
Like, there's no way.
I don't think anybody would do that. So I feel
like it was a figure of speech.
Yeah, I don't blame him. But yeah, what do you think is happening? Like, you know, it seems like there's always a reason as to why it goes up and down. You know, there's people shorting it. What are you seeing?
I feel like there's a lot of excitement around both Bakkt and Libra that contributed to Bitcoin's resurgence.
Yeah.
Almost up until it hit $14,000 or not too long ago this year. However, once some of that excitement died down, for example, Libra is now basically in regulatory purgatory, and Bakkt has been launched to not that much fanfare. Like, volumes are still relatively low. And then there was additional excitement from Xi Jinping saying that China's embracing blockchain, and then people being somewhat disappointed when they see that they mean blockchain but not cryptocurrency, and then they start cracking down on exchanges and like banning Justin Sun's Weibo account and making it so that he potentially can't re-enter the country. Like, there's a lot of mixed signals from China on that front. So it seems like there was a lot of positive news to look forward to, and now the big thing that's still coming up is going to be the halving. So it seems like the price has been inactive proportional to those events, in addition to regular volatility. Like, if you have large upward price swings, there should be the potential for similarly sized downward price swings. So that's those large fluctuations are normal considering how much it moved in the upward direction.
We've been in an up market for like the last 11 years now, right? And things have been good for a long time. There's signs that maybe we're going into recession or that, you know, things are going to kind of tighten up here. What's really interesting is that you have folks that say a lot that, you know, when shit hits the fan, you know, Bitcoin's going to skyrocket because people are going to look for ways to like move their money, right? My unpopular belief on all that is when those types of scenarios happen, when there's recessions, people like to have liquid cash, right? People like to be liquid. And so often you see people trying to liquidate properties or, you know, just have a higher cash position. So, you know, I'm not an economist. I don't know enough about this kind of stuff as other people do, but I can't help but think a lot of people will sell their Bitcoin in that scenario to have more liquid cash on hand.
Well, if you're talking to a Bitcoin maximalist, they would argue that Bitcoin is liquid cash on hand.
For sure, for sure. How about this? Anybody non-Bitcoin maximalist?
I will say that I'm not sure that the assumption that Bitcoin is a safe haven asset it has been tested, because we have been in a bullish market for the last 11 years. Just in the last few days, we've broken new stock market highs 2 days in a row. So it's hard to say that, like, Bitcoin on a month-to-month, day-to-day, year-to-year basis has been uncorrelated with the stock market. But what about the overall global economic trend? Will Bitcoin be resilient in the face of a worldwide recession or a U.S. recession? And it's really hard to tell in that particular scenario, because Bitcoin is a high-risk, high-return asset. And typically, high-risk, high-return assets tend to perform well when markets are performing well as well, like when markets are robust. Otherwise, people tend to park their money when the risk of recession is increasing in bonds and commodities. So if Bitcoin has a behavior like a commodity, then maybe it might appreciate in times of economic recession. But so far, Bitcoin hasn't really been stress tested in a scenario where, if there is a global recession, will Bitcoin remain resilient? And I think that right now, that's still uncertain.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting. Like, I would, you know, perhaps it's just a little bit of both, right? Like, you definitely have your people that are going to move into that or outside of the legacy into that. But, you know, no doubt when money's tight, you know, you need cash, you know, to purchase goods. And it just depends on where, I guess, we're at on the adoption life cycle standpoint, right? So, like, if people are demanding payment in Bitcoin, then now Bitcoin becomes more valuable, obviously, right? So, but, like, if recession hits and people are like, give me $100 bill Benjamins, and I don't care about what Bitcoin is, right? Like,
I do think that's a big difference between gold and Bitcoin, even though that they're compared oftentimes. Like, Bitcoin is still tiny compared to gold. Gold has approximately a $14 billion dollar market capitalization versus Bitcoin, which is still under $150 billion.
Sorry, you said, I think you said, so you mean 14 trillion?
It's 14 trillion. Gold is 14 trillion.
Yep.
So it's an order of magnitude difference between the two assets. So in a recession, Bitcoin could get steamrolled for any number of factors. Maybe one hedge fund, which is a major holder, just feels like liquidating its reserves that day so it can move into some low risk bond play or to some treasury bills. So the idea that Bitcoin could be a hedge against recession is still quite untested. And the people who are promoting that feature of Bitcoin typically tend to be pretty largely invested themselves, and also tend to be cheerleaders for BTC.
Yeah.
So I find it hard as someone who tries to be a moderate about the cryptocurrency space to say with a straight face that yes, if with the risk of recession increasing, Bloomberg recently put the probability of a recession within the next 12 months at 27%, that you should put your money into Bitcoin, because I don't think that's necessarily a smart idea, and you certainly shouldn't be taking your stocks and putting it to Bitcoin. But if you are concerned about a recession, taking your money from the stock market and putting them into longer term bonds might be the safer thing to do.
Yeah, I am not a financial advisor. I don't know anything about these kind of things. I just like to talk about it. So
I'm a journalist. I don't even have money. So
yeah, do not take our advice. These are just, you know, opinions. But yeah, we'll see. Like, you know, for me, I the only crypto that I have is Bitcoin. You know, I definitely would love to see it to go up in that type.
Wouldn't anybody who holds Bitcoin?
Yeah, in that type of scenario, I would definitely love for that. You know, I'm excited to kind of continue to learn from and hear from, you know, honestly, like some of these Bitcoin maximalists that I think are doing a good job of educating folks. And, you know, I hope they're right. I'd rather, like I said, I hope they're right. I'd rather them be right than me be right in that scenario. But, you know, I just remember in 2008 where, again, you just had people like going from there, just trying to liquidate because I want to have cash because I'm afraid that that's going to continue to go down. Right. It's just a natural behavior. What else? What are kind of the top things that happened in blockchain this year?
I think DeFi is starting to really spread its wings. It's cool to see a lot of these things like MakerDAO and a lot of these other
BlockFi and
new lending systems like that all popping up in 2019 has really been eye-opening to see that. I think like the year of 2017 and 2018 was the year of the ICO, and then the ICO is getting eviscerated.
Yeah.
And I think 2019 was kind of the birth of DeFi. Well, in a meaningful way.
And what's interesting is a lot of what's happened on the DeFi stance has been, you know, DeFi in terms of Bitcoin usage, right? Like, I mean, like those have been the strongest DeFi tools have been those that have allowed you to kind of utilize or get the most out of your Bitcoin.
So the risk with that, though, is most of these DeFi, if you're loaning out your Bitcoin, the primary use for that is to lend to people who are either gaining leverage or opening derivative positions against that. So oftentimes you might be, for example, assisting somebody else to short the market or to long the market with that Bitcoin. And that poses counterparty risk.
Oh, interesting.
So if someone defaults on their loan because they get liquidated or their controls weren't safe enough, then you might be out of luck. BlockFi or Celsius or wherever you're lending your Bitcoin to, what happens if they go bankrupt? Will you be covered in that circumstance? And does 6% interest justify the risk of them lending out your coins and then potentially never giving them back?
I'd have to imagine that there has to have some level of insurance on that, right?
Maybe, maybe not. They're insured like Gemini is, but they're not required to have FDIC insurance because it's not a bank deposit. It's a speculative asset.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
And even if they did have insurance on it, like, think how much the insurance premiums would be. Like, in what case, who would be providing this insurance, and who's going to be insuring it? Like, yes, you have to think about the systemic risk in this kind of system. Like, even if they are if there is insurance, they have to be paying high premiums. And then how are they going to be paying those premiums? From what revenue? So in whatever case, there's risk that counteracts the potential interest you could be gaining from lending out your Bitcoin. And that doesn't mean necessarily that whatever interest that they're providing you justifies that risk, because it's really hard to calculate the odds of these really unlikely events.
Right. I mean, there's definitely some significant downside risk in a, call it a crazy scenario, right? Like in a D-Days type scenario, which is like the reasons why you want Bitcoin.
It doesn't even necessarily have to be a crazy scenario. Just the other day, I saw someone picketing on behalf of a user who lost 100 Bitcoin on Bittrex, and they lost their Bitcoin in a SIM swap attack, and Bittrex would not reimburse them, allegedly not reimburse them those funds. So there are a whole number of things where it doesn't necessarily need to be the person who is borrowing those Bitcoin failing, but it could also be someone intercepting or hacking in between that system, or maybe a failure, you sending it to the wrong address, or there's any number of risk factors associated with dealing with another intermediary who is custodying your Bitcoin on your behalf. So taking into account that risk is quite difficult. And it's at least should give you a moment of pause before you consider lending out your Bitcoin, especially if you're trying to hold for multiple years at a time. Is it worth whatever rate of interest that they're giving you?
Right. Right. Yeah, I think, you know, DeFi is definitely interesting. It is also interesting there is a lot of DeFi companies that aren't DeFi, right? Like just kind of leveraging that name
or that, that word there. What else? Anything else we should talk about?
You tell me.
Do you think Santa Claus is a Bitcoiner?
I feel like he would benefit from a miner to keep warm.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
I will say that I think 2019 was the year of a lot of new products starting to get tested and brought into the market. In 2020, I think we're going to see some solid consumer and retail use cases beyond exchanges start to proliferate. So it's going to be really interesting coming into this year to see what new innovations and products we start to see hit the retail market and really help spur adoption. Things like Lightning Network, ETH 2.0, all the DeFi, obviously, which we talked about, and a lot of these consumer devices like wallets, home miners, all sorts of different gadgets that will start to bring cryptocurrency and Bitcoin into the mainstream.
Yeah, I think, yeah, if we're going on like what we think will happen next year, I think the companies that kind of raised traditionally in your traditional, you know, give up equity scenario, you know, sure, there's going to be natural companies that are going to not survive, just like any startup. But I think we'll actually see a thinning down of companies from that had ICO'd, right? Like companies are running out of cash, or they should be by now after 2 years of running without having profit. And I think we'll actually start to see bigger companies start acquiring some of these companies for pennies on the dollar, just for the tech. Tech and team. So we'll see.
I think one of the reasons why a lot of these ICOs are now folding is because they didn't manage their treasuries appropriately. Mm-hmm. Everyone thought that the party was going to continue indefinitely, so they held a lot of their funds in coins rather than liquidating into fiat or something more stable, and then they just get destroyed when the market took a hit. So the companies that did adequately hedge themselves against a potential market downfall are the ones that are still surviving and still building through this this sideways market.
For sure. Yeah, so that'd be really interesting to see. Yeah, I agree with you. I think we'll actually start to see, I think another interesting thing that could happen in 2020 is another FANG company. So Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, come out with their own crypto, like Libra-esque type of thing, right?
Or try to come out with their own crypto.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely see that happening. And it makes sense. It's like if you are any one of those types of companies, you deal with lots of transactions, and you are all about keeping people inside of your network anyway, right? You don't want them to leave your network. So like, why not create the currency that has usage throughout each aspect of your network? I definitely can
like
see
Uber
that.
Cash.
Yeah, seriously, like Uber Cash, Starbucks, the Stardust
Rewards program.
Yeah. Yep. You know, like all the
gold member or whatever it is.
I mean, even Google, right? Like there's so many things that you use Google for, right? YouTube, Gmail, Google.
Well,
Analytics.
The interesting thing about Google is that they don't make very much of their revenue from the consumer, like paying subscription side of things. They make more money off of advertising and
for sure
and data. So for Google, they might not actually be ones that are most interested in providing a cryptocurrency, but a consumer retail facing company like Apple, on the other hand, they have Apple Pay. They might be more interested in trying to involve themselves in that market.
Yeah. Well, Mitchell, this has been fun. What are some ways that people can stay in touch with you?
Well, you can follow at CryptoBriefing, crypto_briefing on Twitter, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn at @MitchellMoose.
Awesome.
So,
and Mitchell, and as we like to do with our guests, what's a question you want to leave the audience with to think about?
I would say seriously consider the people that you trust with. Who do you trust, and whose opinions are you going to listen to when you're making an important decision like investing in Bitcoin or getting involved in this technology? So I'd be very skeptical of anyone who is heavily cheerleading this technology, but people who are themselves skeptical about Bitcoin and themselves critical about some of its underlying flaws, those are the people you should watch out for.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, if you think about, we're all going to cheerlead the things that have the best interest in.
Most right? conflict of interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just human nature, right? Like,
So I'd say that the takeaway for today is look out for Bitcoin moderates if they exist.
Oh, like follow Bitcoin moderates, like people that are pragmatic, basically. Yeah. I think I'd consider myself a Bitcoin moderate.
You think so? But yeah. You say you only hold Bitcoin.
Well, so...
I'm not saying that means you're not a Bitcoin moderate, though.
No. But, like, I guess because someone was asking this, like, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist when you think of in the sense of, like, from a cryptocurrency standpoint. Like, that's the only cryptocurrency that I think there's value. But I do think there's tons of value in blockchain. I just don't think we're there yet. So I always say Bitcoin, the blockchain that doesn't exist yet, and then kind of everybody else is below that. And obviously things that are happening in Ethereum are really interesting. It's just not fully all the way there, all the way ready. And so maybe ETH 2.0 or once there's proof of stake becomes that blockchain that doesn't exist yet. You know what I mean? Maybe. One of these FANG companies create their own things that works for them. And then is it then really blockchain or not? Which then again is what makes Bitcoin so interesting to me. We'll see what happens. It's, I'll tell you what, it's just a fun space to be in and just fun things to kind of talk about and learn and see what's happening. I just like the fact that going back to the DeFi is like, we're seeing more people have products and usage for Bitcoin and other things.
Absolutely. It's fun to be on the edge of this new technology and get to play with all these new products coming out every day.
Yeah, 100%. Awesome. Well, thanks so much, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Happy holidays.
Thank you for listening to the TF Blockchain Podcast. Please help us continue to spread blockchain, Bitcoin, and crypto awareness by sharing this podcast, attending our events, following us on social, and rating and reviewing this podcast by clicking all the stars on our homepage so we can be more accessible across Apple, Spotify, and all podcast platforms. Thank you for your support. Keep learning, keep growing, and keep building. The views and opinions expressed at TF Blockchain events and podcasts are solely those of the ones presenting and do not necessarily reflect the positions or opinions of TF Blockchain. TF Blockchain is not responsible for the opinions or content of its guests and does not endorse any particular company or currency. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be used to make investment decisions.